Hi. So I've been charged with teaching everyone ADA-CFT this week. And according to my calculation, this task is only 1/6 as hard as Gary's task yesterday, because the graduate class I taught on the subject was only one semester, and I have 3 lectures to do it. And so if you Google these words, you can find the lecture notes from that class. I'll put a link on the wiki space when I learn how to edit it. This is my plan. But the basic goal is to convince you of some version of the following bold assertion, which bold but so far vague assertion, which is that some quantum field theories are quantum theories of gravity. And okay, so this is vague enough that it just provokes a few questions, which are which quantum field theories and what the heck is that? And so the more useful version of the assertion is, so this is assertion A, assertion B, is sometimes that theory of gravity is classical. And therefore, we know what it is. We know how to compute things with it. And so then there's of course a third question, which is when. I want to try to answer these questions. And so in doing this, I have two sort of conflicting goals. One of which is to convince you that some version of this assertion is true, and the other is to convince you that some version of this assertion is interesting. And the reason that these two goals are conflicting is because the examples of this assertion where we understand it best and where we have very precise checks of it are for theories which maybe aren't so relevant for condensed matter physics, and for observables which maybe aren't so relevant, so namely things that are protected by supersymmetry or integrability, that kind of thing. And so the compromise that I'm going to try to strive for here is rather to show you how the machinery of this correspondence works, and how to compute things which are of more universal interest, hopefully, and in a bigger class of theories, and hopefully at the same time convey some idea of the scope of this correspondence. So for namely which field theories, for which field theories is this true, and this involves giving up some precision about exactly which theories they are. So okay. So to begin, I'm actually going to follow for a little while the logic of this paper, which gives some derivation of this correspondence, which with a liberal use of hindsight, but without the use of string theory, and so I think that's a useful perspective to take here, and so to get some idea of what such a useful precise version of this assertion might mean. I want to bring 3 facts to your attention, which will give us some hint as to what it might mean. So the first fact, to prepare us for the first fact, I should say, what do we mean by a quantum theory of gravity? And a useful definition for our purposes is a quantum theory where the metric is dynamical. So let's not argue about that definition. I think it's a good one though. And in enough dimensions. More than 3, I guess. This usually means that there are some local degrees of freedom of the gravitational field. So in particular, if you linearize the equations of motion around some solution, included in the spectrum of fluctuations is something that we might call a graviton, some spin 2 massless particle. Let's give this definition. Quantum gravity is quantum mechanics with a dynamical metric. Yeah, please. How dynamical? What does that mean? So that's a very interesting question. Well, let's see. So presumably there are some choices of that definition which don't make sense with unitarity and these kinds of things. Some are better than others. Let's have a good one. So whatever a good definition is. So that's a question to be decided, and I think for everyone that's a question to be decided, not just for today. So having started with this includes in big enough dimensions includes some kind of fluctuating propagating mode with two indices, a massless mode which is symmetric in two indices. The statement that some quantum field theories are quantum theories of gravity, and this statement are in apparent conflict with the following theorem. Which is due to Weinberg and Witten, having made a statement that's vague enough to provoke everyone, I'll now make a statement that's precise enough to wake up the mathematicians, hopefully. And the statement of this theorem is that a quantum field theory which has a Poincaré covariant stress tensor . So here I'm talking about a relativistic quantum field theory with a stress tensor, this is not such a strong demand. Stress energy tensor forbids massless particles with spin bigger than one. Particles with spin bigger than one can't carry momentum, is the statement of this theorem. This seems like a strong statement, right? So this idea that we'd like to find a theory of gravity which emerges from some well-defined microscopic quantum theory is, it's a goal that people have had for a long time, and so of course people have proved that it's impossible. But there are a few loopholes. So the first loophole is the one that's taken by GR, which is that in GR I just said that there's a graviton. But the stress tensor, the total stress tensor, the one that includes both the matter stress tensor and the stress energy of the gravitational field, is proportional to the variation of the action with respect to the metric. This is more or less the definition of the stress tensor. And this is Einstein's equation. This is the equation of motion for the metric. And so that's just zero. And so we can add not equal to zero there. And so the matter stress tensor need not be zero by itself, but it's also not gauge invariant, because if you change coordinates, it changes. But there's another loophole. Yes, please. So good. So there's a three things. So the statement is that you can prove that they can't carry momentum. They have and p mu is integral of this particular moment of the I think in the free theory this will vanish. All right. The spirit of the theorem is to try to understand whether it's possible for such a mode to arise as some composite object, you'd like it to be a graviton which couples to the stress energy of the matter, and I think even if there is a loophole for a free theory, I would be okay with that. I think there isn't though. Mm-hmm. I mean, it rules out the free theory. Okay, yeah, that was my impression also. Sorry. It's either zero or not covariant, right? The proof is what Joe said. You look at a matrix element between one particle states of the stress tensor, and you can prove using Poincaré invariance that it's zero and that it's equal to the momentum of the graviton. I did rely on Poincaré invariance here. You could ask whether it's possible in a non-relativistic theory, but I claim that this class of theories includes relativistic theories, and so for our purposes, this is a relevant objection. But like any good nuclear theorem, it's a sign pointing away from wrong directions, and there's another loophole, which is the one that we'll take in this gauge gravity duality, or I don't know, whatever we want to call it. This graviton mode, according to this assertion, needn't live in the same space as the field theory, right? So graviton can live elsewhere. Other side. Which part can't you see? You can't see the... Okay, where's the lowest you can see? This is the lowest you can see?
Yeah.
That's good? Okay, all right, thank you for telling me. All right, so we'll put a line here. All right, good. So the second hint here is gives us some hint about where elsewhere is, and this is the holographic principle. Okay, so this is a big subject, but hopefully I can convey the idea. The idea that there should be such a principle follows by combining the following two facts, both of which Gary explained. So fact one is that if you have enough stuff and you stick it together, it'll collapse into a black hole. So stuff can gravitationally collapse, and this is what happens if you put enough stuff in one place. The second fact is that a black hole has to be assigned an entropy. Let's say it has to be assigned an entropy which is proportional to the area of its horizon. And this is in order to have a consistent set of laws of thermodynamics, which includes black holes. I think we'll talk a little bit more about this 2 days from now. But for now, the basic statement is just that included in the total entropy of the world is the entropy of black holes, which has the form A divided by 4g Newton. And this is in any dimension. In general, in, say, d plus 1 dimensions, the Newton constant has units of length to the d minus 1. If we make a length out of it, it's called the Planck length. I'll probably accidentally say that word. And so this thing is dimensionless in any number of dimensions. And so this holographic principle is the idea that combining these two facts implies that in a quantum theory of gravity, in any quantum gravity, the maximum entropy of some region, some region of space, let's call it V, is proportional to the area of the boundary. The area of the boundary of the region. And so a rough argument that this is necessary is the following. This argument is due to Bekenstein. Is the volume. So suppose we have such a region. Suppose we have some region, let's call it V. Let's call A is the boundary, and suppose it's in roughly flat space. And suppose you have some configuration of the system where. Suppose there's some configuration which has an entropy bigger than the black hole entropy. And by the black hole entropy, I mean the entropy of the black hole that just fills the region. So the entropy of the biggest black hole that you can put in there. So the biggest black hole is the one whose horizon area is A. So this is A to the B. So this is the entropy of the biggest black hole, which according to this Bekenstein-Hawking formula is A over 4GN. Then okay, so I hope you're all tempted to do the thing which completes the proof. Namely, you take a bunch of stuff, take whatever junk you have, and just toss it in. Right? And this increases the entropy of the system, because you're not keeping track of what the junk is. And it also increases the energy because of the idea that stuff that carries entropy also carries energy. And so that's really the only extra assumption that goes into this. And so if you do that, both S increases and the energy increases. And if you do this until you make a black hole, if you do this enough, the energy gets bigger. The thing gets dense enough, it collapses into a black hole. Eventually, it'll turn into a black hole, but the entropy of the black hole is smaller. And so the entropy decreased. And so then you use this to solve the energy crisis, if it's possible, but probably this means that it's not possible. Okay, so so the conclusion of this argument, which there are perhaps more rigorous arguments than the one, is this statement is this holographic principle that the maximum entropy. Oh, sorry, I wrote it here. Is that in a quantum theory of gravity, the maximum entropy of a region is the area of the volume. And so this should be contrasted with the case of ordinary systems, like a quantum field theory with some cutoff or some spin system, where the maximum entropy is the log of the dimension of the Hilbert space, which grows like the number of degrees of freedom, which in ordinary system is proportional to the volume. It's extensive. Okay, and so this statement suggests that any quantum theory of gravity should have a number of degrees of freedom scaling like that of a quantum field theory, some ordinary system, in a smaller number of dimensions. Okay, so that's the conclusion of this hint number two. This seems like a crazy idea, right? That such a thing shouldn't be described by a local quantum field theory. The main question that it raises is who were these extra dimensions? And to understand that, let's look at hint number three, which comes from Wilson, from whom we learned that a quantum field theory should be organized by energy scale. As a family of RG trajectories. So trajectories. So there's some set of coupling constants. Let's call them G. And they depend on some energy scale, which I'll call U. And so some picture of this is like this. So at short distances, we have lots of stuff. We do some blocking transformation. We get slightly less stuff. We do another one. We get less stuff. OK, so there's some coordinate U, which says how fine our lattice spacing is. And here's this direction as U goes to infinity. This direction as U goes to 0. Some energy scale, and these directions are space. And an important point about this procedure is that the rule for the evolution of the coupling constant as a function of energy. This is the thing that's beta function. The beta function that determines the evolution only depends on the coupling constant at the scale where you're evaluating the left-hand side here. It's local. The RG equation is local in scale. Okay, so this this suggests that that we can associate the extra dimension with this energy scale. I guess I should mention for completeness that the locality in the extra dimension that's suggested by this argument is actually quite a bit weaker than what we'll get. The answer is actually better than this, as Joe has emphasized recently. But this is the hint that we want. Okay. Please. Between different what? Okay.
Beta function has a property followed from the constant Q.
Good. Yes.
So I don't understand how
Well, so the extra dimension, the theory in the extra dimension that we're going to talk about, the one we understand, will be more or less general relativity, which will actually be more local than is suggested by this argument. Yes, and actually I think it's fair to say that to the extent that we understand that string theory is also local, despite appearances. Please. Okay. Right. Good. Yeah. So. Right. So. There's. Definitely. In here, we made this assumption that increasing the entropy required increasing the energy. Maybe it's so. This kind of argument has this thing called the species problem, which is if the field theory if in this theory there are many degrees of freedom, then. There's some proportionality constant, which is not in the favor of this argument, I think is. I think you could have the graviton end some kind of topological degeneracy, presumably. I think it counts. This is an interesting loophole. I don't have anything more to say about it. Okay, good. All right, so at this point, I guess I should mention, lest you get the idea that I'm saying more than I am, that obviously a quantum field theory that we understand perturbatively isn't a quantum a theory of gravity in large extra dimensions, right? You can sort of tell, and so the field theories that we're talking about will necessarily be at least somewhat strongly coupled. And this is a good opportunity, I think, to mention a useful principle in this sort of business, which I seem to have taken to calling the principle of conservation of evil. Which is just that different weakly coupled descriptions, like a weakly coupled field theory and a weakly coupled theory of gravity, should have non-overlapping regimes of validity. So, different, let's say, calculable descriptions. Calculable descriptions shouldn't overlap. So when one is applicable, the other should not be. And so this, of course, makes this kind of statement hard to check, but it also makes it very powerful, if you happen to believe it. Okay, I just mean you can figure out what's going on. I don't know. I mean, should I try to be more precise? I think it's a rough guideline, right? So okay, I will now attempt to become slightly more precise for those of you who are bothered by this. So to become more concrete, let's think about the simplest example of this, which is the case where the right hand side of this equation just vanishes. In which case, this picture, the Hamiltonian on each slice of this picture will be self similar. And so let's think about this scale invariant case. In which case, there's a symmetry of this form acting on the space and time coordinates. So this mu runs from 0 to d minus 1. I'll take d to be the little d to be the number of space-time dimensions. And then if this extra dimension, so I guess I should say, often in the relativistic case, this also implies conformal invariance, but we won't need that right now. And so if we want to associate this extra dimension with an energy scale, then in a relativistic theory, this scale transformation should take u to lambda inverse times u, right? And energy is like 1 over a time. And so with this information, let's try to guess what kind of state of a theory of gravity could describe such a theory. And so the problem is actually very highly constrained. The most general d plus 1 dimensional metric with Poincaré invariance and this scale invariance up to coordinate transformations is this ADS metric, which Gary wrote at the end of his talk. So this is ADS in d plus 1 dimensions. And so the fact that it's Poincaré invariant is just the statement that this is the Minkowski metric, this is the special relativity metric, and u doesn't transform under Poincaré transformations. And then the fact that it's scale invariant is just comes from the fact that we scale x and u oppositely from a scale invariant by itself. And this metric actually happens to automatically be conformally invariant, which I won't. Good. I'm not super smart. Apparently that's not true. In that case, we don't understand in this way. So it turns out that the case with the negative cosmological constant is simpler. I mean, it seems like it's not because there's curvature, but for this purpose, it turns out to be simpler. And That's right. That's right. Well, good. So the important question that you're asking is what's fixed? What's held fixed in this path integral? And the answer is the asymptotics. So there's some region that you should think of as far away, which in Minkowski space is some more confusing thing. In ADS, it's actually much simpler, and the answer is just the boundary. So the region near the boundary, which Gary talked about. So there's let me draw one picture in global coordinates, just because it's easier to picture. So there's this radial coordinate, which is like this coordinate u. I'm sorry? Ah, thank you. I thought you were talking about the Poincaré horizon. Okay, good. okay, good. So, right. So here's a picture of ADS, and there's a boundary. And the important thing, which I'm about to say in a few minutes, is that in this sum over metrics and over the matter fields in ADS, we have to hold fix their form at the boundary. And so I'll elaborate on this much more in a minute. That's a good picture. Yes. So there can be other degrees of freedom, but they're set to zero in this background. Right. So yeah. Good. So what I was just about to say. Okay. Let me say it over here. So this thing solves the equations of motion of the following action, the following class of actions. Let's call it S bulk to emphasize that it's the action in the bulk of the metric. And let's leave some room here, which takes the following form. It's an integral over d plus 1 dimensions with some, let's put some constant out front, 16 pi is equal to 1. I'll try not to set I equal to 1. Okay. Of this square root of g, so I guess I should define this. By square root of g, I mean the square root of the absolute value of the determinant of g. It's this thing that lets us do a coordinate integral of the most relevant term, which is the cosmological, let's call it minus 2 lambda here, and then the next least irrelevant operator, which is this Einstein-Hilbert term, and then plus dot, dot, dot. Okay, and so So from this formula, this formula is what determines this statement that the Newton constant has units of length to the d minus 1, just using the fact that, remember, r goes like a second derivative of g, and g is dimensionless. So I should say what the dot, dot, dots are. So the dot, dot, dots are two things. So first of all, it includes more irrelevant operators made of the metric. And secondly, it includes, in principle, other fields which vanish in this solution. And I'll call the solution the vacuum solution, because this is a solution which preserves all of the symmetries of a conformal field theory, right? It's a solution which preserves all these symmetries, which if we were in some state other than the vacuum of the theory, it most certainly would not. So that's a reason to use this term. And so there can certainly be lots of other fields, but just as long as they don't get excited enough to change the equations of motion, this is the solution. And so so I guess here I should make a comment. This kind of action, in addition to being the thing that you would guess just by naturalness, in that it's most general thing that preserves the symmetries and is some expansion and derivatives, is also what we get from vacuo string theory that where we can actually compute what the form of the effective action is. And it's what we get in vacuum string theory at low energies, and when the curvature, there's one thing I have to say. There's this L in the solution, and there's this lambda here. The relation to solve the equations of motion in general dimension is, minus 2 lambda is dd minus 1 over L squared. And so this is what we get from string theory. When this curvature, this is 1 over L, L is the radius of curvature of this ADS, when this curvature is much less than the string tension, then this length scale, there's some length scale associated with the massive excitations of the strings. So when we can ignore these things, this is what the effective action looks like. And so I guess I should say that really the role of string theory in this discussion is to fill in the dots here. It's to say which ways of completing those dots have this indicator of ultraviolet completeness from string theory. Yes, please. I mean, it's certainly not. So there's this coupling constant here is dimensionful. Right, so it has units of length to the. So this is definitely an irrelevant operator. So this is not preserving the gauge invariance, which is this general covariance, and not without introducing other fields. So I think it's a good effective action. In that sense. Yes. Good. So I've written this lambda here, which certainly can be renormalized by the things like what you say. But this actually brings me to my next comment, which is that this theory here is classical when this h bar in front is the effective h bar is small. The effective h bar is this ADS radius in units of the Planck length when this thing is much bigger than one. And so in that limit, and we'll figure out what that is in terms of the field theory in a few minutes. In that limit, those effects are small. Did I get that right? Okay. So my next comment actually was addressed to this question of the asymptotics. So what I've said here suggests that some class of conformal field theories, indeed relativistic conformal field theories in d dimensions, are related to gravity on this ADS. Equals one, and I need to correct the statement with a very important here, which is this word asymptotically, because indeed, as Shivaji has been noticing, this in the theory of gravity we're integrating over the metric fluctuates, and so certainly, you know, there are other metrics that need to be included in the path integral, and The thing that's fixed is only the asymptotics of the metric. And what I mean by asymptotics is near the boundary. So remember, ADS has a boundary, which in these coordinates is u goes to infinity. It's the region where the proper volume of these slices blows up. So conveniently this is a picture of into this Sitter space. And the boundary is in this region over here, where the volume of these things blows up, and one way to think about why we have to specify boundary conditions in this region is the statement that logistics reach this boundary in finite time. So this was something that Gary said, that the fact that null GD6 reaches in finite time, and we have in our spectrum a massless propagating mode, this graviton, and so therefore, which therefore can send signals along such GD6, means that in order to specify the future evolution, so given some set of data on some initial time, so this direction is time, I should say, if we specify this initial data, we can't determine what will happen unless we also specify data on the boundary. And so for this reason, we have to fix this data at the boundary of ADS. And in fact, how we specify the data at the boundary will be the whole magic of this machinery. Okay, one more general comment. Which is that different conformal field theories, maybe this is obvious, correspond to both different bulk actions and different field content in the bulk. So different collections of dots here. Please. Which one? Okay, which one? This one. Oh, so we put in scale invariance here as an assumption. Right. So are you worried? Certainly not. So good. So the question there's scale in the gravity theory. I mean, there are two length scales in the gravity theory, right? There's the Planck length, and there's the ADS radius. And the question is whether using this thing we can compute things which don't have a length. Yeah, okay. Right. A reason you should at least temporarily believe me is that this metric has that its isometry group is the relativistic conformal group in D dimension. Yes. That's right. I agree. Yeah, we'll get there. Good. So the next That is exactly the Euclidean version of what I'm saying. That's right. These statements are both true. Completeness. Okay. Okay, so the reason they get to infinity of finite time is not too hard to see. It's because there's this cancellation in here. So that is a feature of the Minkowski signature geometry, which is absent in the Euclidean signature, right? It's because in here there's a minus dt squared and a plus dx squared, which can cancel each other. And that possibility is of course absent in the Euclidean case. It's still true that if you integrate at fixed time from some point in the interior to some point in the boundary, the geometry of fixed time is just a copy of hyperbolic space with one smaller dimension. So that's the same statement that you're making. The statement that null GDS reaches the boundary in finite time is made possible by that minus sign. Good. Thank you. Good. Okay. This time. Good. Yes. The other way around? Yeah, no, the other, yes, the other way around. So there is a multivaluedness that we'll talk about in it, hopefully next time. But the statement is intended to be a precise identity, namely, any observable that exists over here, you can compute over here. It should be the same as the observable over here. So if the theories were different, you could tell. The sense in which there is some double valuedness over here is that we have to specify the boundary conditions in the bulk. And different ways of specifying the boundary conditions, in fact, can give different field theories. So you should include that as part of the data over here, and then it's one-to-one. Hopefully I'll make that clear next time. Okay, so my next goal is to give some idea of a more precise dictionary between these two things. The space is too valuable to leave here. Okay, good. We'll get there. So that means that something will break this U goes to lambda inverse U symmetry, right? There are many ways to do that, just like there are many relevant operators. So one thing that could happen is just that the metric could take a slightly different form away from the boundary, one which isn't scaled, right? So that's the general kind of thing that will happen. Good. So here's the dictionary. So I'm going to refer to the gravity side as the bulk and the field theory as the boundary for hopefully clearer reasons. And so the basic statement is that fields in this asymptotically ADS theory of gravity correspond to local operators in the CFT. So if I have some field in the bulk, it has some index, which can be spin indices, flavor indices, gauge symmetry indices. That will correspond to some operator, which I'll call O, which has the same labels. And so these things can include spin, charges, and so those things map to, or just map to each other. And the mass of the bulk field will correspond to the conform, will determine the scaling dimension of the operator. So the eigenvalue of the dilatation operator in the conformal group. And in the particular case of scalars, I'll write it over here, the relation, which we'll derive next time, is this, that the mass in units of the ADS radius is this. So delta d is the number of space-time dimensions of the field theory, and delta is this scaling dimension. And so, one immediate lesson that we get from this is that in order to have a simple theory in the bulk, one where there isn't an arbitrarily large number of fields which we have to worry about, we need to have some sort of small number of operators, some small collection of operators, which have a small scaling dimension. So you see, if as the dimension of the operator grows, the mass of the bulk field grows. Small number of low dimension operators. So if any of you have some list of such conformal field theories, please tell us as quickly as possible. Okay. All right. And so the situation to which we should contrast this case is when the tower of string massive string excitations matters. And so a set of observables that I think should be of interest to all of us are the core of our correlation functions. For now, we'll think about vacuum correlation functions of these local operators.
Okay,
Good. Good. So yeah, good. So this is an important point, which I was going to come to later. So we can organize the both hand side in terms of representations of the conformal group. And so right, so I can put a derivative here, I can put a derivative here. So let's just erase the derivative. Yeah. Well, you can figure it out from this formula, right? So we'll talk about this. Okay, good. No, it means that the excitations of the field grow towards the left in the picture. Right. That's the simple answer, I think. I'm conflating two things with this picture, because really, that's right. So this, we've made this connection between the extra dimension and the energy scale of the field theory. That's right. So the field corresponding to a relevant operator has the property that its solutions grow away from the boundary, and irrelevant operators have solutions which grow towards the boundary. All right, you're stealing all my punchlines. okay. So let's consider a useful collection of observables, where, in vacuum, we take some string of these local operators, and think about their vacuum correlation function. And let's think about the Euclidean case for now, for simplicity. And so a useful way to organize this information is to make a generating functional, which you can think of by as some perturbation of the Lagrangian of the CFT. Let's assume that a Lagrangian exists, just for notation. So perturb the Lagrangian of the theory by some sum over these over these labels of these operators, which have a lower index, multiplied by sources. So these j's are meant to be arbitrary functions, arbitrary sources. And then we can define this generating function to be the excitation value in the original CFT, whose Lagrangian is L, of this, this thing is called L sub j, of this perturbation. And this product of local, this correlation function of local operators is obtained by differentiating the logarithm at j equals 0. Okay, so far this is just organizing the information of the field theory, and the important question to answer is how to compute this thing using this gravitational description. And a hint about this is that this perturbation of the action that we're making here is a perturbation by local operators, right? We're changing the action by things which are at points, arbitrarily well-resolved points in the field theory, and according to this dictionary, things associated with distances are things which are to the right of the picture, are near the boundary of Van der De Sitter space, and so this suggests that to make this perturbation of the action, we should make some perturbation of the boundary conditions in ADS, and this turns out to be true, so this next formula I'm about to write is sort of the key formula, so I'll make some room for it. So it generally goes by this collection of letters, which is the statement that this generating function in the CFT is, the general version of it is that this is equal to the partition function of the quantum gravity evaluated on this asymptotically ADS space with boundary conditions that depend on the J's. And I won't specify how they depend, because this is something which, in general, we don't know what the heck it is. But sometimes, and it's our next goal to figure out when, sometimes this integral can be done by saddle point. This path integral over the metrics can be done by saddle point. That's when the gravity theory is classical, which I'll denote in this way. So sometimes this path integral has good saddle points, in which case this is equal to e to the minus the action of the saddle point, which I'll just write. It's this bulk action evaluated on a solution, evaluated on the solution of the equations of motion with, again, boundary conditions that depend on J. Which actually, maybe I can be a little more precise. It's that the field phi corresponding to the operator O behaves near the boundary like this source J. Okay, so this is the most important equation. We should stare at it for a little while. And so yesterday someone said the word instanton in the context of thinking about the black hole. So this is the sense in which that there are instantons involved. There are saddle points of the Euclidean path integral whose contribution we're evaluating. So in this asymptotic limit, we can ignore those if we're interested in questions that. Right. So there. I mean, there is some in this limit. There is some expansion in powers of 1/n, and the contribution of the fluctuations are down by powers. Yeah. But indeed, it's of interest to understand those. Also. Yeah. Good. So right. So that's why I put this little twiddle here. we'll talk about this. Yeah. So let's put it in quotes. Maybe. We'll make it more precise. Yes. What? Let's see. So, certainly the fluctuations will also make contributions to the free energy. In this approximation where there's a good saddle point, they're suppressed by powers of this contribution. Yeah. So we'll talk about free energies. Okay. So are there questions about this formula? This is the important thing. So I think the next thing I want to make a check that this picture makes sense. Yes, yes, please. Yeah, this is a good question. There isn't a general answer. String theory is helpful for this kind of question. there are some operators where the answer is simple, this is jumping ahead a little bit, but let me just give an example. So one field which we know is always present in the bulk is the metric. Right? We said it's a theory of gravity. There's a field which is included is the metric. And so one thing you notice is that the indices here have to be conjugate to each other. Right? We have to be able to contract this index with that index. Thing which the boundary field theory we think always has is a stress tensor, and those two things are conjugate fields in a sense. So the source for the stress tensor in the field theory is the metric in the bulk. Yeah, I mean it means you introduce some perturbation of the boundary conditions of the metric. Associated with how you want to source the stress tensor. Right? It's more or less this. So just replace phi with G and the behavior, you want the behavior near the boundary to be the source for the stress tensor. of the filter. So to compute a two-point function, you have to differentiate this thing twice with respect to that source. Different numbers of mu's and nu's. Okay. Yes, right. So yeah, so mu and nu run from zero to d minus one. There's an important issue of gauge invariance in bulk. It's useful to choose a gauge where you pick the polarization along the radial direction to vanish. Okay, so I think people are probably hungry. So let me just say one more thing for today, and then we'll carry on attempting to make this more precise next time. I want to demonstrate that this correspondence that we've been talking about is actually a realization of this holographic principle, that the counting of degrees of freedom can actually be correct. And so I think this is illustrative of the correspondence. So holographic counting of degrees of freedom. So I said that the maximum entropy of some region in a quantum theory of gravity should be the area of the boundary of the region in Planck units divided by 4. And so we can ask whether, in this correspondence that we've stated, that's equal to the number of degrees of freedom of the field theory. Okay. And the answer is yes, because they're both infinite. So we need a regulator. In the field theory, we know how to regulate this. We need two kinds of regulators, in fact, because this is doubly infinite. So for the field theory, we can put it on a lattice, introduce some short distance cutoff. So at each site on this lattice, there's some number of degrees of freedom, which let me call it just for convenience of notation. Let's call it, just arbitrarily choosing a name, let's call it n squared. So at each point in space, there's n squared degrees of freedom. N squared is just a name at this point. So at each side in the lattice, there's n squared degrees of freedom. And let's call the lattice spacing delta. And then there's also an infrared divergence because the number of degrees of freedom is extensive. And so let's call the size of the space, let's call it its linear dimension r. And then given this, the number of degrees of freedom, the maximum entropy of the field theory, so that's on this side of the correspondence, is it's the number of cells in this picture, which is r divided by delta to the d minus 1. D minus 1 is the number of space dimensions. This is a picture of the space of the field theory, times this number n squared. Okay, so this is the number of degrees of freedom of the cutoff field theory in a box. This is the number of cells. And let's ask, what is the area of the boundary in the bulk? So a picture of this geometry at fixed time, so remember this is a picture of space here. At fixed time, the ADS metric looks like this. Oh, this is annoying. I'm going to have to change coordinates. Which for everyone's own good, I'm going to do right now, because it's going to happen eventually anyway, is I'm going to introduce a new coordinate for the radial direction. So previously I wrote the ADS metric like this. What did I call it? I'm going to introduce a new coordinate, which let me call it z, just because it's easier to write. So z is equal to l squared over u. So in terms of the coordinate z, the boundary of ADS is at z equals 0. This coordinate is better because you have to write fewer symbols in writing the metric. Okay, and so this is just a change of variable. So that, okay. So the law, it's not the number of states, it's the log of the number of states. It's n log 2, right?
Yeah.
Thank you. N squared is the number. It's the number of degrees of freedom per site. So it's this. I'm saying that there's n squared spins per site. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. No, that's correct. That's what I meant. So it's n squared per site times the volume. Yeah, right. Sorry, this was the mistake. Right, but it's not a problem with the log. There's no problem with the log. The logs are what, this is what I meant. So I mean, by n squared is the number of spins, more or less. The number of spins per site. Let's talk about this more afterward. I'm sure that this is what I mean. So the metric at fixed time is L squared times dz squared plus the metric on space, which is just R3 over z squared. And so the area of the boundary, it's an integral over the boundary, which is, that means z fixed and t fixed, of the square root of the metric that's left over, which is just this metric, over space. And so this diverges also for two reasons. It diverges because the integral over space runs over an arbitrary distance, and also because this thing diverges as z goes to 0. So let me evaluate this over here. So here's a picture of the ADS. So this is the behavior of this sort of scale factor so ADS is a bunch of slices of Minkowski space, which vary in size as we vary z. So this is z equals 0. This is z equals infinity. And we're going to introduce two cutoffs. So there's a cutoff on space. So these directions are space of the field theory, which we'll call R. And then we'll also introduce, following understanding of the radial direction, a cutoff on the distance from the boundary to which we approach the radial, to which we approach. So this, and let's call that delta. So this will be a UV cutoff on our field theory. It corresponds to some UV cutoff on the field theory, not necessarily the same one, but the scaling is the same. And so with these cutoffs, the area of the boundary is integral 0 to R d minus 1 times the square root of the determinant of this metric, which is L over Z to the D minus 1, evaluated at the cutoff, Z equals delta. And so altogether, this is R L over delta to the D minus 1. And setting this divided by 4G equal to this maximum entry of the field theory, this thing I call n sub d here, for number of degrees of freedom, so first of all, the parametrics in R work. So this goes like R to the d minus 1. So the both-hand side goes like R to the d minus 1. And to make the coefficient work requires L to the d minus 1 over g Newton. So this is the ratio, is precisely this ratio which determines whether or not the gravity theory is classical. It sets this equal to this letter n squared. Okay, so we learned two things from this check. The first thing we learned is that the parametrics and the number of degrees of freedom work. On both sides, the number of degrees of freedom scales like the volume of the boundary, not counting the holographic direction. And the second thing we learned is that in order for the gravity theory to be classical, so that we said that happens when this combination of scales is much bigger than 1, we need the field theory to have many degrees of freedom per site. Right? We need some large number of degrees of freedom per site in the field theory, which is this thing called n squared. And so next time we'll start by asking how that can be accomplished. Okay. So maybe we should eat. Okay, so good. There's a little bit more information in the topology going into the statement that there's a boundary. So I guess the key word is the word conformal that Gary used yesterday. The important sense in which there's a boundary is precisely this statement that in order to determine the future evolution of a state at fixed time, you need to specify the data on this slice. That's the important sense in which we have to specify extra information at that boundary. There is actually. So a useful analogous statement is, this is a good opportunity for me to say this, I wasn't going to have time, is a fancy math theorem, which is due to Graham and Lee, which is the statement that if you have an asymptotically Euclidean ADS space, and if you specify the asymptotic behavior of the metric, and demand that the metric in the interior is smooth, then it's uniquely specified. So I think that's a useful analogous sense in which in order to have a well-posed Dirichlet problem for the metric, you need to specify exactly this amount of data. So I think that's the Euclidean analog of that statement. Yes, please. E to the minus 1 over n. Sorry, I would have said e. So definitely there are e to the minus n effects. E to the minus n, yeah. So they're small when n is large. But there are, as Gary says, there are qualitative things that are different between finite n and infinite n. So many of them having to do with, for example, the black hole information paradox. But they're subtle things, at least the ones that I know. Good. So a useful statement in that direction is there are certainly things that depend on finite n that we can compare between the two sides. So that's of course a different statement than establishing it at finite n. So there's quite a bit of evidence that it's also true at finite n. Of course, it's not established in. Is it 7,000 now? Okay. Yeah, that's it. Good. So that's a statement of a very different character, right? I think the principle of conservation of evil says no, right? Because you know everything about the 2D-IZ model, more or less. And you know from that information that it's not a theory of gravity in three dimensions. Right, and 2+1. Right. Exactly. Well, right. A simple statement that I can make about that is that this number is like the central charge, and so the fact that it's small means that. This thing, which is controlling whether the gravity theory is classical, is small. Yeah. Ooh. Good. Let's see. QCD. That means with matter. So in the case where there's no matter, there is a string theory interpretation of that. Let's see. What is the story in the case of the matter? Okay. Ami Katz wrote a paper about this recently. Is that right? Yeah, there have been attempts to interpret that using your gravity adult. You're raising this as a possible violation of conservation of evil. let's see. I mean, I think the answer is that it's not classical, right? It's the higher derivative terms in the bulk action are important. In that case. Good. So we'll talk more about the precise role of n. The short answer is yes. right. Yeah. So large n doesn't automatically guarantee. So the thing that here is that n controls the coefficient of the Einstein-Hilbert term. There are of course many other terms whose coefficients I didn't say, and they can be very dangerous. I think that something that will illuminate this will be the discussion of what I refer to as a tuftology.
Okay.